Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
Welcome back, everyone. Our guest today is Brandon Webb, a combat-decorated Navy SEAL sniper turned entrepreneur and author who has built two brands into eight-figure businesses. As a U.S. Navy chief, he was head instructor at the Navy SEAL Sniper School, which produced some of America's most legendary snipers, including Chris Kyle, the hero portrayed in the hit Hollywood movie American Sniper. And from what I've gathered, Brandon speaks a lot on his Instagram channel about overcoming fear, and it seems like he spends a lot of the time flying his plane upside down over Manhattan when he's not doing that. We have a mutual friend in Ukraine who twisted his arm to come on the podcast. Really happy to have you here, Brandon. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So I Googled the fuck out of you before this interview.
Mostly good stuff. Yeah.
Hope all that was accurate.
Yeah, no, that was good. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah. The other thing I did, I watched a bunch of Navy SEAL movies. I even saw some of your interviews. It seems like in terms of like how accurately Hollywood portrays the SEALs and Buds and Hell Week, from what I've seen from you, so they get that right some of the time. They miss some of the, you know, the accuracies about like, you know, the scope on people's rifle not being, you know, in the shot or whatever. But you think Hollywood does a decent job?
No.
No? Okay.
Yeah. I would say they do a good job entertaining people. Mm-hmm. They don't do a good job on the technical aspects. I ripped into American Sniper. And look, I'm sometimes at the detriment to myself, a very honest person. I went and saw American Sniper because we reviewed it for my media company at softrip.com. We get these early screenings and I sat down in New York and they wanted a review, right? They're like, hey, go watch this and hopefully Brandon writes a review on the movie. I think they automatically thought I would just give this glowing review because Chris was a friend and and a student at the sniper program. And I saw the movie and I was like, oh my God, this is so bad. From like, they're showing sniper instructors yelling at students like they're in boot camp. And I'm like, we don't do that. That's so unprofessional. And then the weapons and everything. And my litmus test was, what would Chris, if he were alive sitting next to me, be happy with the military technical side of the movie? And he would have lost his fucking mind. Really? And that's why I ripped it apart on my review. And it's like, people are like hating on me, like, oh, what do you know? You know, they just, you know,
what do you know? You're like, I was the head instructor at the sniper
studio. The studio's upset. Now they won't, no more invites coming my way. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, fuck, you wanted it straight. I gave it to you. And then I had time. I did follow it up with a review. And this is what I was getting about with Hollywood does, you know, do a good job on the entertainment side. What I did appreciate about the movie American Sniper was it, and I thought Clint Eastwood did a good job, is they showed the toll of what happens to the families back home, right? I think showing, like, portraying what happened to Chris's wife and the family, and it's very hard on these families, and it's very complicated because sometimes and this is very well known in the case of Chris Kyle, the immediate family, his mom and dad, brother, are at odds with his wife, with the widow, Taya. And that causes a lot of family drama, and it's like, you've got to choose sides, right? And I just try and like stay out of all that stuff. But generally, the most accurate, I would say, Navy SEAL movie I saw was Act of Valor, and they used real SEALs in that movie. They're not actors, obviously, you can tell that in that movie, but very technically accurate, that movie. And then as far as like depicting training, Buds 234, which is a Discovery Channel show, like followed a class 234 around, and that is a very, I mean, it's just pretty much, you know, aside from missing out on some of the, maybe the barracks banter and stuff that goes on behind the scenes was a pretty good portrayal of how tough that training is. And look, even Dan Bilzerian, which everybody knows now, Dan went through Navy SEAL training twice and didn't make it through. Like, and yeah. I don't know the full story. I've heard we do this thing called a peer, you can peer people out where the instructors go at the end of the class, like at the end of this like grueling program, and they say, who did we miss? Like, who's lurking here that shouldn't be in the teams? And then you write down a name on a list and you like slide it in anonymously. Okay.
Is that 27 weeks? That
about 7 months.
Okay. Yeah.
And look, that's not 7 months and you're a trained Navy SEAL. That's just to get through the door so you can start training, start doing like the real training.
Your sniper school came after that, right?
Yeah. So anyway, my point is it's an incredibly tough program. And it's funny because Dan and I got into this big thing about, because he was on the movie Lone Survivor.
Right. And,
he bought his way into that movie.
Yeah, I saw he had the one line.
It was a huge controversial thing because my friend Marcus didn't want him on the set when he found out who he was. And Marcus was like, you're a buds quitter. You know, you're a SEAL quitter, Dan. And Dan's not, like, to his credit, he didn't quit, but he got booted out for some reason. I don't know.
Someone wrote down something?
I don't know. I heard that he got peered out. Mm-hmm. Or the instructors just didn't like him. So whatever reason, that's what happened. But when you go through that, you go to a 3-month tactical training program, you get assigned to a SEAL team, and then it's another year or a year and a half of additional training with your SEAL platoon and some specialized personal training for yourself. Like, I went to sniper school. I went to learn how to repair the Draeger rebreather system. I went to the factory and took a factory course because I was the diving support guy. And I also went to an Army parachute rigger school to learn how to sew, pack, and repair larger parachute systems. So I would maintain the platoon's parachutes when we go overseas. So a lot of additional training that happens after that. And then you deploy. And once you got a deployment under your belt, you're kind of like considered a member of this community. So it's a long time.
That's insane. So that was what for you? So it sounds like 2 or 3 years prior to deployment. And then how long was your tour? You did a couple tours, right?
Yeah, I did a tour in the Middle East. It was on, we were doing ship boardings back when we were doing the UN sanction, enforcing the UN sanctions against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who was smuggling oil out of the country against the sanctions. It was a massive, you know, profitable business for the smugglers. And we would board those ships at night, take them over, sometimes have to cut our way inside because they would weld themselves inside the ship. So we were doing that. My first deployment was SEAL Team 3. Then the USS Cole got bombed in Yemen by two terrorists in a small boat, almost sank, you know, $1 billion warship in the harbor. Went down to the Cole, set up a security perimeter with a special boat team, and I had it was me and a few snipers set up a spot on the ship to kind of keep people at bay, because the government, U.S. government, was worried the ship was going to sink. Like, any, if they, somebody farted towards the coal, that ship would have sank in the harbor.
Wow. So, crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. Then I came back and we had a problem platoon. Like, you know, we don't always get it right. This platoon at the team, everybody knew about it, called Echo Platoon. Totally dysfunctional, not working. It's like in business, right? When you hire the wrong people, sometimes the people are good people. They're just not, there's no chemistry in that team. You see it a lot in sports too, right? Where you have these superstars that don't get along. You know, everybody has to kind of realize they have a role to play. they disbanded this platoon, and I got asked by Kevin, our ops officer, hey, would you go into this platoon and kind of help rebuild? So I jumped into Echo Platoon, which I didn't want to do necessarily because it had such a bad reputation. And I had been in a really, really good platoon as a new guy. But jumped into Echo. And Echo was actually supposed to deploy relatively quickly. I think they failed their operational readiness exam. So you train as a platoon, like 16, 18 guys. At the end of that year or year and a half training cycle, you take an operational mission readiness test. And if you fail, it's a big deal. And I believe that they had failed, and then they just broke it up and reformed it. And they were next out the door. So then I jumped in there, was being one of the guys with experience to kind of rebuild that team. They put more new people in there. We had a lot of really good new guys that just didn't have good mentorship. So I was doing that. And then 9/11 happened, and I found myself deployed overseas with this kind of like misfit platoon, which I took a lot of shit from these guys. But again, it's like, I'm honest about it, right? And like, guys don't like to be, even in my first book, The Red Circle, you know, it's funny because you don't realize, people say, oh yeah, you can tell that story. And then the book did really well, and all of a sudden this person that gives you permission to tell this story, they become famous for something they didn't want to be famous for. Like one of the guys in the book quit. He literally quit SEAL training and just kind of like escaped accidentally. And he became like, oh, you're the guy that quit in Brandon's book. And that's like, you know, it drove him nuts probably. So you just don't realize what, if I had to rewrite the book, I would have changed everyone's name and still told an honest story. But
yeah, I saw one interview where the reporter kind of asked you, he mentioned like some people were like saying like you broke the SEAL code or some bullshit like that about writing about it. And your response was like, well, when you're in the SEALs, of course you're not going to do that, but you know, after, like, people are going to write, people are going to, you know, speak up about it. And
yeah, that's, yeah. Look, I've never, there are certain groups that I worked with outside of the SEAL teams that I just don't talk about. Like, I've signed those non-disclosure papers and I know I can't talk about it. I trust me, I've asked formally to, like, finally years later talk about it and write about those experiences, and they said no. So I'm like, okay, I can't do that. But you know, to talk about my SEAL experience, I don't have any problem with that. And a lot of it's been super therapeutic. And a lot of these guys that, and I was an early, like Marcus Luttrell with Lone Survivor, and Chris and I, we had our book come out within a month of each other, American Sniper and The Red Circle. We were all very supportive, but we were the first guys, and we took a lot of crap from the community. And some guys that were some of the most vocal guys about us writing books now have books of their own and big podcasts.
Of course, right? And you blaze the trail.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I think you're always gonna, trailblazers are always gonna take the kind of early hits. It just comes with the territory. I mean, it is what it is. I think writing for me has been really therapeutic. I've lost a lot of friends in the war, writing about it. I wrote a book called Among Heroes, donated a bunch of money to military charities with that book. It's just therapeutic, man.
That's a good way to honor those guys too.
Yeah.
And people get to know them and know the families. And yeah, I mean, just from my research, it's been really cool just getting the humanitarian, the humane side of it, and the impact of, like, you know, what happens when someone goes to war, doesn't come back. And, but so what made you decide to become a SEAL in the first place?
So I, as long as I can remember back to my Robotech cartoon watching days, I want to be a pilot. You saw my Instagram, I fly today pretty regularly, but sometimes, you know, life nudges us in certain directions. I had my parents move from Canada to the US, had a dream to sail around the world on a sailboat. My family, my sister, myself, mom, dad, and our dog lived on a sailboat for 5 years, did a lot of sailing through Mexico, on and off, homeschooled. When we were living on the boat in California, my mom came home one day and said, "Hey, there's this scuba diving boat that's looking for a young kid to kind of work for tips." And the captain said he would train you how to scuba dive. And I'm like, that sounds amazing. So I got this incredible job. It was the second real job I had. At first job was sweeping up a boat store, which was just horrible.
Like, sounds like it smells bad.
Oh yeah, mopping the floor, sweeping, just like thankless, low pay, but those kind of jobs build character, I think.
For sure.
And then I got this amazing job opportunity. And so I started working, and I would like take the boat had a private chef. We had a hot tub on the boat. We would take sport divers out to dive, you know, these incredible islands off the coast of California called the Channel Islands.
And I grew up in Huntington Beach, so.
Not yeah, so you get
those are just north of Santa Barbara, right? Or off the coast of Santa Barbara, I think. Right?
The coast of Santa Barbara, kind of from like Oxnard to Santa Barbara, and then a few south of that, San Nicolas Island, Santa Barbara Island, and then Catalina, which you've seen off the coast. But incredible job. Like I learned how to scuba dive. I was making really good money as a by the time I was 13, I was, you know, probably making $100 a trip. And I was trading you couldn't sell your lobster or abalone, but you could kind of do these backdoor trades. So I would like trade the sushi bar. I had like $500 in food credit because I'd give them lobster and abalone. So take my family out to dinner. It was a great job. And then I started making real money when I was 15. I was getting paid a deckhand wage. And you know, I would work summers and weekends on the boat, overcame a lot of my fears. I remember, sorry, this is going to be a long answer to your SEAL
question. Oh, that's great. Go for it.
This is laying the groundwork. I remember getting woke up at 2 a.m. at San Miguel Island, which is the furthest north of the Channel Islands near Point Conception off the coast of Santa Barbara. And we were there because it's a beautiful island. It's very hard to get to because the weather is so rough. But when you can get there, the underwater scenery is like going back 50 years in time. It's just the species and the population are incredible. It's also a big seal and sea lion habitat, which great white sharks feed on. So we were out there, and this crazy Captain Mike, who actually like did a whole trip to hunt a great white shark in Spirit. He's a crazy fucking guy. So Mike wakes me up at like 2 a.m. at San Miguel Island. He's like, "Hey, Webb, go get your wetsuit on. You got to dive and get the anchor unstuck." Because the weather had gotten rough. We had to move the boat to calmer water in the middle of the night. And I was just like thinking to myself, like, that's crazy. Like I've done that in the daylight before, because the chain would get wrapped around a big reef structure. And, you know, I dive down, and that's fine in the daylight when we're not in like shark infested waters. I was just like thinking about it. I'm like, this is crazy. And I'm like coming out of REM sleep. I'm cold, you know, now I got to go put a wetsuit on and dive 50 feet down. And what I know is going to be shitty visibility. Like you can see this far. But I'm like, okay, I guess I got to just, what am I going to do? Like, I don't want to let these guys down. So I just had to like swallow my fear and do it. But stuff like that, where you end up doing it and realizing, okay, that wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
At an early age was a real benefit.
Oh, you were 15 when you did that.
I wasn't even 15. This was like, this was like my first season on the boat. I was 13.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I'm terrified to scuba dive, by the way. So I have like insane respect for seals. Yeah. 'Cause like, that's like the ocean is my biggest fear, admittedly. Yeah. And, you know, just any of that shit just scares me to death, but that's amazing.
I remember this dive. Like, I'm like, I have a big flashlight and I'm going down the anchor chain, holding on the chain, and I'm seeing these like bioluminescent flashes go by me. It's the seals. Like they're everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, good. they're here, that's good. There's no sharks around. Because when they vanish, you know there's a big great white in the water. But it was just brutal, man. Getting down and seeing this massive ledge, like the size of a automobile, and just like it was rocking up and down with the chain and the boat.
Yeah, how do you even get that unstuck? I mean, I guess
you basically signal, you blow a bunch of bubbles to the surface, then they pay out slack, and you swim it around, and then you blow another set, which means they can start pulling it in, and then you watch and make sure the anchor goes, and then you can surface. But yeah, that was all like pre-Navy SEAL training for me. So I ended up working that boat all through high school. My parents took this big trip on our sailboat to New Zealand. I didn't want to go. I had this great job and making good money as a teenager. But I left on this trip when I was 15, about to turn 16. Went from Acapulco to the Marquesas Islands. Then the next chain was the French Tuamotos, and then Tahiti, which is the Society Islands. And my dad and I had this massive argument over seamanship, and he was like, I think you should leave. And so I left home at 16, grabbed a backpack, a couple $100, and found a boat sailing to Hawaii. And then called my...
He didn't want you to be a seaman, or he...
No, we were just arguing. It was like teenage, typical like father, teenage son bullshit.
Right.
I had a big chip on my shoulder. I was a smart ass, and I would say, look, why are we doing this? We should do it this way. Mm-hmm. My mom said it was like having two captains on the boat, and she's like, in most cases you were right. And then you would end up being right, and it would drive your dad nuts. So, you know, the lesson that I reflect back on in life is, you know, one, I have a ton of respect for my parents who put us on a sailboat, sailed halfway around the world before we had fucking GPS. Like, we were taking star and sun sights with a sextant. Wow. We had sat nav. Luckily, every 12 hours, if you caught the satellite, you would get a position fix. So, like, you know, my dad had some major stones to take the family and do that kind of thing. But when I think back, I'm like, this is a lesson in leadership. Like, you really have to understand sometimes, even though you may know best, you need to know your role. And I wasn't the captain. You know, my dad had a ton of responsibilities outside of like choosing where to anchor and what kind of sail to use on a given day. There can be one captain, right? Having two captains, you know, one person has to lead. Mm-hmm. And sometimes good leaders have to be good followers. And I wasn't a good follower. My dad fucking kicked me off the boat because of it. We got in a big argument. And he's like, I think it's time for you to leave home. And he got, you know, kicked out when he was 16 for not cutting his hair in Canada. My grandfather was a strict kind of Irish Canadian. Mm-hmm. He was like, cut your fucking hair or get out. And my dad left and moved to Malibu. And so, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So,
your son's 16, you have a son or you have daughters?
Yeah, no, I have kids. And
okay. Well, when they're 16, you know what you can do.
I'll never kick. But the point is, to answer your question, make a long story longer. I came back to California. The owner, Bill, of the boat let me work on the boat. I had a little less than a year of high school to finish. I finished it, and I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with myself? I don't have the grades to go to any of the naval academies or to get into one of the officer training programs at one of the universities. So I started looking at the Navy, and then I read a book on the Navy SEALs called Rogue Warrior, written by the founder of SEAL Team 6, Dick Marcinko. And I said, I can do this. Like, and it's a challenge. It's like, it's a challenge to myself, and I wanted to challenge myself. And so I started doing research and ended up joining the Navy after high school. And I had a pretty great run. The Navy paid for my college. I had an amazing time in the military. You know, I went to combat in Afghanistan. I saw enough to kind of like feel, you know, because look, I would be lying if I said that you don't want to test yourself, right? Like you don't want to do all this training and then never deploy into an operational environment. But I had did that in Afghanistan. It's like, you know what I did? I did probably 20 plus combat missions and could, you know, sleep well at night knowing that I had what it takes. I didn't, you know, and I'm telling you, I've seen a few SEALs that were, when it came down to it, that moment of truth, that couldn't do it, like, or were on that fence. And I'm like, oh man, like, I would have never thought I would see that day. But the point is, you know, I could get off that helicopter ramp in the middle of the night and go do my job and know that, you know, I got the job done and kind of tested myself in that combat environment. And it had nothing left to prove to anybody, including myself, which is the most important person.
Yeah. Like there's not a lot of feelings in life that beat that, you know, where you're like, all right, I've done this thing that was really hard to do.
Yeah.
It took me a really long time. And you kind of know that you've accomplished that. Like you can, I mean, that builds so much character and confidence.
It's, you know, or else I would always wonder, right? And that's why a lot of guys that had left the SEAL teams before 9/11 came back in, because they never got to test themselves in combat and answer that question, do I have what it takes? And so, you know, so I, you know, that's how I became a SEAL. I spent just under 10 years in the SEAL teams. I came back from Afghanistan, got involved in instructor duty as advanced sniper trainer. And then I got recruited by a guy named Bob, who was SEAL Team 6 senior chief, to help modernize the Navy SEAL sniper program. And at the time, we had two programs, East and West Coast, and we wanted to kind of consolidate the way we trained and also become better trainers, modernize the course with technology, but also like, how do we coach better? How do we be better instructors? So we had unlimited resources and work with some of the top mental management professionals in the world, in the Olympic arena and the professional sports world. A great experience. Invested a lot of time. But I was having marriage issues and I kind of saw like we're in Iraq now. And I started to kind of start paying attention to more like the geopolitical situation. And it's like, what are we doing? Like, we're like, what's the purpose behind Afghanistan? And I started asking these questions and seeing this like never ending war happen. And I'm like, okay, I need to go. Like, it's my time. Back to when I had that crappy job as a 12-year-old sweeping up the boat store, when I got a job on the dive boat, I'm like, this doesn't seem like work. This is fun. And I learned that lesson early on. And I said, I made that promise to myself. I'm never going to do a job that I don't like doing. And the SEALs got to that point for me in 2006. I said, it's been great. I'm not having fun now. It's affecting my personal life. I want to be, you know, around, see my 5-year-old son, you know, play baseball and sports and be there for the fam. So I left in 2006 and people thought I was crazy. They, you know, and what I learned is when you're in the brotherhood, you're in the brotherhood. When you're out, you are out cold.
Yeah. And
guys were pissed off because I had just gotten, I got early promoted before I took the sniper job. And then I made chief because I was filling a billet. I was a sniper course manager as an E6 and it was an E8 in rank. So two ranks higher job. So I made chief my first time up and guys were resentful. Like, oh, you just wasted this promotion. I'm like, no, I didn't. I fucking earned it. And now I'm getting out and going on to the next phase of my life. And so I left in 2006, got into entrepreneurship and just really, you know, had a bunch of failures, had some success, thankfully more success than failure, learned from it and drove on. I started getting into writing after I lost my first startup and the housing crisis of 2008, got a book deal that got me into writing, blogging, media. And, you know, today I run a digital media business, I write on the side. I just wrote my first novel, which I sold to Random House this summer. I've had a great pandemic. Not going to lie. I made a decision early on when the world started going to hell. I said, you know what? I'm going to use this time to really, because I know the way people think. They get down.
Yeah, actually, one of my questions was like, what is going through this pandemic like as a Navy SEAL or someone who's seen crazy shit? I've had a great pandemic, by the way. For me, it's been a total blessing in disguise. Not to, I'm sure a lot of people watching, might be, thinking like, oh, this is horrible. But, these opportunities of despair can be the best opportunities of growth. Yeah,
I know, having been through SEAL training and watch 90% of my classmates quit, mm-hmm. Or fail out because of their mindset, knowing how a lot of people, and it's unfortunate that a lot of it has to do with the environments we grew up in and the cultural social pressures where they kind of condition a lot of people, if they don't have good parents or good environments, to just kind of like accept it and be like, okay, I'm going to spend 2020 watching fucking Netflix and feeling sorry for myself. I knew that the bulk of the people would be in that headspace. And I'm like, I'm going to take some territory. I sold a business that was struggling. It grew, like we had grown. I had grown a subscription box business called Crate Club. It grew way too fast, out of control, 0 to 15 million revenue in a couple of years. And then COVID hit our supply chain, just disrupted the whole thing, sold to a competitor. I'm like, okay, it's not as big of an exit as I hoped for, but it was a good one. I needed to sell it, sold that. Then I was like, okay, how do I go on offense? My old CMO, Alda, her and I were talking about health and wellness and that there's an opportunity in the kids space. We co-founded a kids vitamin business called Tiger Gummies together, raised money for that, invested in it, launched it. She's running it today. Looked at my core media business and said, okay, time to kind of get that back in shape. Started really looking at producing better content, getting rid of some people that needed to go, that were not on board. I started focusing on that business. Like, okay, these guys clearly aren't on board with like where we want to go. I finished my novel, which I've been working on for a couple of years, sold it to Random House, the biggest advance I ever got. Immediately ended up in a bidding war with like the top streaming networks to turn that book into a TV series. Just sold that this week.
Nice, congrats. That's the one about the serial killer on the
aircraft. Yeah, aircraft. We sold it to Peacock.
Oh, nice.
And now I'm like investing in real estate. I bought a self-storage investment business that's doing well.
I've heard those are really good investments, by the way.
Yeah.
Because no one ever takes their shit out and they pay forever. And
yeah. You could raise the rent 10-15% and you're not going to take your crap out of storage. And if you're paying $80 or $100 a month to store something, is an $8 rent increase really going to kick you?
That's one of the biggest things I tell to guys who come in my program. Like, if you have shit in storage, burn it, just donate it. Like, it's the biggest, because you'll never use that shit. But sorry, tangent. Anyways, go on. No.
In most cases, I will say I gave up my New York City apartment and have a lot of expensive furniture in self-storage in Hoboken, New Jersey. So,
okay.
Generally, I would advocate, yeah, it's mostly crap, but there are the circumstances where you've got expensive stuff with nowhere to put it.
Totally.
But the point is, I just decided to have a good pandemic and I've had one. And I remember having calls this summer, even with my editor, and we were checking in. She's like, oh my God, it's so nice just to hear you talk about year 2020. Cause I've been in this like conversations in the workplace with people that are just down and depressed and lost a job. And look, I have friends in the food and beverage industry. And I think that's one of the ones that got hit the worst. A friend that I had met who managed one of my favorite restaurants, she started messaging me like, what do I do? And I could just tell, I'm like, oh wow, she's in a really bad that headspace. And I was even giving her, like, she was asking for advice, because I'm not a big fan of sharing advice unsolicited. I think it's abusive.
It's annoying, for sure.
Yeah. She was asking for it, and I was giving her all this advice, like how to start a business, how to change career, just right over the head. Because she, I was like, okay, she's just not in a place where she wants to listen. She more, I think, wanted me to just be miserable and be like, oh, that's terrible. And yeah, that sucks. And it's like, no, I'm just not that way. Like, it's, I mean, what a fucking time to live in, to reinvent yourself, make a career change, start a business, buy a business. There's so many businesses for sale in America that are cash flowing, where the owner just wants to retire. I looked at a wine business in the city. The owner's late 70s, just wants to like hand it off to somebody, finance it. And it nets like $300K a year. Like, you can, you're in a pretty fucking good living off $300K a year net. And this guy, so these opportunities are out there. It's just, you know, you got to be in the right headspace to kind of look at things.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many people that, friends of mine, people, they spend all their time watching the news, watching the worldometer of how many cases, how many doesn't. Like, why would you waste your time on that? Like, I got Corona back in June. You know, I lost taste and smell for about 10 days. Met my girlfriend the first day I had it. She heard I had Corona and she was like, I'm not scared of Corona. She came over. We shared a fucking shisha together. so I, you know, and not to say, like, I also had a friend's dad who died from it, you know, but he was older, who had complications, but
Bobby would have died from the flu too.
Exactly. He was already in the hospital. But to live your life as if this, you know, this disease, being a young person, is going to, you know, radically change. It's just such a bad, it's such a bad math decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's sad. And as a living in America, and it's somebody that loves New York City as much as I do, to see the fear-based decision-making and the just, I'm not going to be politically correct here, but the retarded decisions that de Blasio has made around, oh, we can keep Saks Fifth Avenue open, but we can't dine indoors. Like, dude, I'm looking at snow-covered streets and like -3 degrees Celsius outside right now. Nobody's dining outdoors. Like, it's miserable. They can't, it's in the delivery guys, it's hard for them to deliver in the snow. And you're just taking away, you know, you've jerked around the restaurant industry for an entire year where it's like, oh, you can go back to indoor with limited amount. They hire people back. Then you change the rules 2 weeks later. My friend got fined $8,000 by the city of New York because he was feeding his staff who had just finished working side by side in the kitchen before they went home. And the city official said, oh, nobody can dine inside. He's like, they've been working side by side to like cook in the kitchen. They're my staff. No, I'm sorry. Here's a $8,000 ticket. So that's like the government's thank you to the heart and soul of New York, which is food.
Oh, fucked up.
Among the entertainment stuff. But yeah, just watching these, you know, government officials make these terrible decisions that, and I think in another life, I would love to be an economist, but it's all about incentives. And people are like, fuck it. I'm going to move to Miami or Texas or overseas.
Yeah.
I was looking at, yeah. I mean, I love Kia, but I was looking at apartments in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, you can go. I mean, I think the one great thing about the pandemic is it's really shown how people can work remotely and work from home and be very productive. And that genie is out of the bottle and not going fucking back inside.
Yeah. No one's going to want to go back to an office that didn't.
No one's. Yeah. Not, there's just no reason for it. Plus it's, I think people now know it's, you know, you've got, I don't know how many millions of square feet of commercial real estate in New York. And they're like, what the hell do we do with this? Like, no one's bringing back 300-400 people and packing them in an office.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. So, but I mean, having that attitude is key. I wanted to circle back and ask you a bit more about, so when you were in you know, throughout your service. You were married at that point. When did you divorce?
I got married when I was 23. It was really the first, I think the first woman I had truly fallen in love with. And, you know, I think we can fall, you know, we're biological creatures, right? We get those hormones going and you know, we can fall in love with multiple people. I think that just happens, but it's the, like a very first time I'd really fallen hard for somebody. And, you know, she was 19 finishing university. And you know, when you're young, you don't think about the future, right? You don't think about, okay. I mean, this is an important thing I've been talking about recently. Cause one thing I did get into, my son got me back into, he's on the chess team at school before Queen's Gambit was like a popular thing. He got me back into chess, and I started getting coached. I started getting coached by a grandmaster, and she was analyzing my games. And it's like, Brandon, you're very good tactically. And I hated to hear this, cause in business, I'm all about strategy, but she's like, you're playing the game with no strategy. And I'm like, holy shit, she's so right. So I feel like that's such an important life lesson, you know, to think about the end game, right? But it just not enough people think about, okay, what do I want out of my life? And so when you're young and in love, you don't think about, okay, what's the future? You should think about together, if you're with somebody, what's the future look like? What do we want? Do we have a shared vision of the future? Or in my case, as we got older, she's like, I don't want to travel that much. I love to travel. I grew up freaking sailing around the world on my parents' boat.
Yeah.
She was a very private person. I'm a very outgoing person. When I left the Navy, I was getting into entrepreneurship and just like sank most of our life savings in my first venture, right? She's like, I don't want to be married to an entrepreneur. So you realize this stuff late in life when you should, you know, you should think about this. If you're in a relationship considering getting married young, are we on the same path? And things change, life changes. But if you have these fundamental differences, they're going to get to a point where you're going to reach a Y in the road and somebody has to really make a hard compromise or the relationship ends. And that's what happened for us. We just decided we wanted different things in life. She wanted more stability didn't want the same lifestyle. And thankfully we broke up in therapy. We had a really good clinical psychologist working with us, and we had young kids, and she coached us on how to talk to the kids about it. Make sure we put our differences aside and focused on the kids. She told me privately, as a therapist, she said, look, I'm going to tell you this, it's going to be tough, but you know, make sure that your ex is happy, because happy mom equals happy kids. And so even like tough decisions that I had to make were, you know, just because of the loss that I was right and I could do certain things and not let her move two counties away, I thought about him. Okay, I'm investing in her happiness because I know that that's going to translate to happiness in my kids. And, you know, right now my oldest son, who was born when I was in Afghanistan, is a math major at University of St. Andrews. He's like tied for number one on the chess team. He is working on a first AI startup because he's big into machine learning. He runs our self-storage business and crushed it for us. Wow. And my daughter is 16, just finished spending a weekend in New York with me because she got hired by Saks Fifth Avenue and Puma to be an in-store artist. Like, my kids are great. They're independent and, you know, yeah. So mom and dad are divorced. Doesn't matter. Like, and I feel like that's probably my next nonfiction book, is about relationships, because most of them, I think in America and elsewhere, the marriages end in divorce. And if you have children involved, a lot of times these parents weaponize their kids. And you're really just fucking yourself for the future. Cause if you have, you know, I don't know many parents that don't love their kids and want their kids to do well, but when you weaponize them and trash talk your ex, you're poisoning your kids, and then they're going to end up with problems. And then you're stuck dealing with like, and it's like the problem of, okay, Hunter, where are you going to do your first semester at St. Andrews? If you can't go to campus, you end up with, okay, where am I going to send this kid to rehab? Or, you know, this kind of, you know, it's just, you know, so I think that.
Yeah. That's so important. Cause you hear so many stories of, you know, going through divorces, dealing with attorneys, it really gets people at odds. And you stop, you know, it's like you want to, you're fighting this fight against your ex.
Yeah.
You're trying to make their life worse versus what you're talking about, which is make their life better. It's just going to be better for you.
Yeah. Better for everybody in the long run. But humans are emotional beings, and it takes a lot sometimes to kind of stuff that, what you really want to, you know, burst out in the moment and just put it aside. And it's, as a single guy, I don't have a problem dating women with kids. My with the exception, which is a big exception, is when I was first divorced and had been on many dates with different women with children, I would say 9.5 out of 10 had terrible relationship with the ex, and I could see it happening. I'm like, I don't want to fucking be part of this. I don't want to deal with throw myself and my own kids into the middle of this like toxic relationship. So I just don't date women with kids generally because of that rule. And that's a whole nother single life's a whole nother story. But as far as that goes, I don't do it for that reason. It's not, you know, it's just generally most people don't have good relationships with their exes, and it's toxic. They're fighting, families are fighting, kids are upset. And I don't want to be part of that. And that's why I'm like, man, I should write a book about this. Cause I have a great relationship with my ex. She remarried, had two more kids. I've like cooked dinner for her and her husband and the whole family before.
Yeah. You absolutely should, because, you know, I'm in the relationship space and you just don't see that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And not enough resources for, and a lot of these like relationship books are written by single psychologists that don't have kids. And what the fuck, you know, like I get you've been educated, but I feel like that's, yeah, I would have something to contribute there. And so maybe that'll be my next project.
Yeah, no, I think you definitely should, because just the way you spoke about it now, it's very radically different from the mainstream sort of narrative out there.
Yeah.
So curious. So in the SEAL program, what's the percentage of single guys to guys like married? Because it seems like just as a civilian, you know, when you just look at the media or whatever, it seems like more guys than not would have like a, you know, military bride or whatever. Maybe they just portray that in the movies.
I mean, look, this is a lesson in incentives. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'm in charge of the Department of Defense, this would be one of the first things I would do is on your enlistment contract, or whether you're officer enlisted, you sign an agreement. You will not be married for your term, your first term in the military. Because what happens is, let's say you're some 18-year-old kid from Alabama. You're like out of the freaking country for the first time in your life. You join the Navy. You get stationed on a ship, and you're living in this like fucking cubicle on board a ship. And then you see your buddy who just got married his college or high school sweetheart. He gets to move off the ship because he gets a housing stipend and gets paid extra. And this kid is like, wait a minute. I can go get married and like move off this crappy ship and get paid more money. So that's what happens. It creates this financial incentive for people to get married. And then that creates a bigger issue, like cultural issue, where it's like, oh yeah, you should get married. So everyone's like encouraging other. And that's why you see a lot of young military marriages, because there's this like financial carrot hanging in front.
That's a huge carrot. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Massive carrot. I know a guy that married a lesbian student at San Diego State. She got free medical, great medical coverage. And he got all the extra money and got to live off base. Like that happens all the time. So I would just like take away that incentive because that is a big contribution to kind of like the culture of it's okay to be married so young in the military. And the aftermath of divorce and drama that comes from that incentive is just, it's a fucking disaster, man. So, to your point in the SEALs, I would say when I was at SEAL Team 3, maybe I want to say like half, just like quickly gut checking it, of the guys who are married. But a lot of it's like being on a professional sports team. You're traveling all over the world. And I know I have really close friends that play professional sports. I would say most of them cheat on their wives because they're out there traveling and they get hit on. You got a few drinks in them and it's like you got some, you know, women throwing themselves at you. There's only so much we can do. Sure. So
a lot of males.
You know, that's just happens a lot. And then you get a lot of marriages that end in divorce, unfortunately. And I'm in this, I have a really good friend that I went to Harvard Business School with, who's my age, lives in Zurich, and he's like my relationship guru almost. I mean, he's got two girlfriends. They know about each other. They know that he's never going to settle down and have kids. And he's like, you just need to start being honest with women about what you want and you'll start attracting the right women to your lifestyle. So I'm just trying to figure out, like, do I want companionship? I do like the idea of having long-term companionship, you know, and I do see, I do know people that have great relationships. They have a good sex life. They get along. A lot of the ones that I see work, it's because the couple and they have something that they do together, even like business related, it works.
Yeah.
And that kind of keeps them engaged, but it's fucking tough, man. Like I'm just finishing that book Sapiens right now. And, you know, I generally would say we're not wired to be monogamous. As men, especially. And that's where I think it gets tough. I do think that's why men take, you know, we call it they mature later. I think generally men are older in that kind of zone I'm probably in their, you know, 40s. And you start thinking about, okay, maybe it's time for me to settle down, because the idea of like companionship into kind of old age sounds great. But I'm trying to figure it out right now, man.
Have you read Sex at Dawn? Heard of that one?
You know what? I have that book in storage. I haven't read it yet.
Very good. It tackles a lot of this. It gets into the science of how men are wired. Are we monogamous? And it's, you know, for me, I'm 38 and I don't have any kids. And that's a totally different discussion for someone like you. You've got, you know, almost grown kids.
Kids are amazing, man. I can tell you this. Because I have a lot of single friends, the same, right? Like single, no kids. It is an incredibly rewarding experience having kids. Like I'm really glad that I have had kids. But anyway, you were going to say.
No, it just becomes a totally, because I have a lot of friends who, like, I'm friends with just some of the most ridiculous, you know, playboys around, you know, living in Kiev, just the shit I'm exposed to on a regular basis. But most of these guys, they get into their late 30s and like, all right, I don't have kids. I'm going to find the nearest playboy model with the best DNA to impregnate and then have the kid. Then they go back to like the, it's very hard for guys to leave that sort of insane single, you know, fun mentality. But it's really interesting from my standpoint, because all the guys I know who have kids, who, you know, have kids are a little bit older, they've raised their kids. They're so happy that they did have kids, and whether or not that relationship worked or not, I don't know. It's just a different. So I ask myself, like, because I also want to have kids.
I do.
That monogamy question is always interesting to ask people, because I've
I do think we're at a place in time and history where we don't have the same social constructs of religious limitations and stuff like that. I feel like if you wanted to have a kid, you could probably find a beautiful, smart woman in Ukraine and say, look, this, you know, let's have a baby together, but I'm, you know, it's not going to come potentially with this traditional idea of marriage. I do know, like, there are plenty of women I know that are in their, they're in that kind of baby zone, right? The late 20s to mid 30s, where they really want to have a baby themselves. And I just had an ex-girlfriend actually, who I'm still friends with, beautiful Russian girl in New York. And she's having a kid on her own. And she's like, couldn't be happier. She's like, really wanted to have a child. So I feel like there are those situations out there where you can have your cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Yeah.
And just be like, hey, let's all, you know, I'm going to be here to support, you know, and be part of this unit. But you don't have to, you don't deal with the same social bullshit that we would have to deal with in the 50s and 60s, right? Where
totally
you're looked down upon.
Yeah.
The world is evolved.
What you said before about just being able to be honest from the get-go. It's, yeah. You know, when you just kind of put it out there, you'll find so many women that are down for that, that are looking for that. Whereas traditionally, like you're saying, in the 50s, like that mentality is a bit new to think like, oh, there are people out there who are looking for that, who want some sort of open sort of, you know, open marriage, open relationship, or just have kids, be good parents together, but have extracurricular activities on the side, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, two other random questions I want to ask you. One, if you had to go as a random person, who's more dangerous, a SEAL or like a trained MMA fighter?
I think a SEAL.
Really?
Yeah. I have a lot of respect for the guys that do MMA. The thing about the difference between MMA and doing like even jiu-jitsu and the SEAL teams. And I'll tell you a quick funny story. So I wrestled in school. I was a pretty good wrestler. I placed second in regionals and went on to, I should have placed third, but I placed fifth in state. So I wrestled and I find myself in the SEAL teams. And I mean, I remember being at this party that my sister went to the same, she went to San Diego State, same town, right? She's going to school. At the same time, my ex was going to school, that the girl I ended up marrying. But my sister threw this big party and there's this guy, big guy, who's acting like a jerk. And so I asked him to leave. He didn't want to leave. And I kind of, you know, grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and marched him outside. And I think it was so, we have a thing in the saying in the SEAL team, violence of action. It's just like, I don't think any, this is the first time in this guy's life, because he's a big guy. This guy's like probably had at least 6 inches on me and 30, 40 pounds. I just like grabbed him and freaking marched him out. And it happened so fast and he was so shocked that he like came back to the door and was like banging for an hour with this guy. And he was drunk too. He was so embarrassed and shocked that he just got manhandled and he wanted to fight me, right? And I remember my friend Jason was there. He's like, hey, dude, just go like kick this guy's ass and get it over with, right? And I'm like, I really don't want to. I'm like enjoying myself. So out I go. And this guy is like a football player for the university. And it's like this big crowd. Like everyone, like he's riled up all his fraternity brothers. And I'm like, really, guys, are we really going to do this? And it's like this crowd of people in the driveway. And this guy takes a swing at me and I put him in I basically sidestep it. I wrap him up and I take him down and he's basically on the ground and I'm like putting him in this like chokehold and he tries to tap out. And I think to myself, like, dude, no fucking way are you tapping out of this.
There's no rep here, man. Sorry.
Yeah. You've got, like, you got me into this shit now. Not a chance you're tapping out. And I So I said, and I was thinking to myself, I'm like, okay, how do I deal with this? So I said, you need to tell, and there's this crowd around, right? I was like, you need to scream. I was like, you need to tell. I remember whispering in his ear, like, you need to say that you give up. Like, I give up as loud as you can. So he screams it. He screams it again. Like, I told him, I'm like fucking louder. Cause yeah. I was choking the life out of this guy.
Right.
And so I put him to sleep anyway. I made him scream and I put him to sleep and I laid him there and I was like, you need to check on your buddy, and make sure he's okay. He was like laying flat on the driveway. And his friend was like, hey man, it's cool. Like, cause it was like, he found out it was a SEAL and he wanted to like, you know, man up or whatever the fuck it was. But I was right. like, you guys need to get the fuck out of here. You're next. Right. And so all his friends like drug him out and left. But that's the difference. There's a certain tenacity and life or death that comes. And I don't like fighting because look, if it comes to that point, I'm going to fucking gouge your eye out, man. Like, I'm going to bite your fucking ear off, Mike Tyson style. I'm going to freaking gouge your eyeball out, pressure point you. I'm going to get some type of advantage and fucking hurt you very badly. Cause I'm in a totally different mindset than you are in the octagon. Going to tap some, try and get somebody to tap out. It's just, it's different between life and death and that mindset. And I've, and it's it, why I don't like fighting is because I've, people generally think, oh, Brandon, like, how could you be a Navy SEAL? You're so nice. And, but when that switch goes off, man, it's on. And I've had people like, whoa, like I've never seen that come out in you. And I don't want to go to that place. Cause I know like when you're there, it's like, we're going to finish this and it's not going to end up with you tapping out. And then that's the difference between somebody that has trained in the special forces and had been in those life and death situations where you're going into a room and you don't know if that guy behind the door has a fucking knife, an axe, a fucking gun pointed at you, a gun pointed at someone's head. And you're going in there to fucking get the job done no matter what. And that's the difference between the mindset. And it's
mindset, yeah. Comes down to like, are you willing, you know, because MMA is a sport, obviously, yeah. versus this is real yeah. life. It's a combat. Yeah.
And now the guys that like Tim Kennedy, who are special forces and an MMA guy, yeah, don't fuck with that guy. But yeah, that's the difference. Cause I've seen it, man. I've seen it and it's a different, it's like the guy at the bar, like shoving. It's like, dude, I'm not shoving you. The first thing that's going to happen, I'm going to smash this fucking glass into your nose. And, cause I know your fucking eyes are going to water and then you can't see and you're going to have blood all over your face. Cause the broken glass. And now I'm at a total advantage. Yeah. It's like, I'm not like, if we're going to go there, like we're going to go there really fast and right. I'm going to end it as fast as possible, as dirty, and any cheating advantage I can get, I will use, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, that answers that question. So that's great. Totally. No doubts in my mind. I wasn't sure what you would say, but that was a very convincing answer. So,
so what's next for you at this point, man?
I got hired to give a talk this summer to a mastermind group. And I looked, this guy was amazing. I'm like, shit, why don't I have something like this? Cause people are always asking me. And I was also thinking about what do I do? What do I do next? Cause I built the Crate Club off of Soft Rep Audience to a pretty big business and then sold it. And it's like, what next? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I naturally just fits well with my writing. I thought, you know, visiting this group in the summer, this guy's like making a couple million bucks a year with this very small team, crushing it. And I was like, and he's a nice guy, but I'm like, there's not a whole lot there. A lot of these guys, even like Ty Lopez, right. They're just kind of like fake it till you make it. I've been there, done that, man. Like I've taught the fucking sniper program and I'm heavy into mental management. I know it really well and I've used it myself. And I just thought, okay, now more than ever with COVID, I'm like, okay, let's do something like this. for SoftRap. And so the idea is it's around mental management and getting a mental edge. And we're going to start selling in January.
That sounds amazing. I checked out some of your videos on Instagram. Dropped a comment about the golf one. I'm not sure if you knew if it was me or not.
Yeah.
No, it was really good content. And I have a mastermind group. And it's an amazing business model.
I was going to ask you how you make money. This is probably not Airbnb only.
No, Airbnb is like the side hustle. This podcast is basically like just a marketing channel to my site where I offer the mastermind group. It's a monthly mastermind group. Guys pay $500 a month. So it's pretty high ticket. It's a lot of the stuff that you talk about, overcoming fear, you know, hitting on girls, building relationships, growing your passive income, a way for single guys to work on improving themselves.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I think it's the best sort of business you can run because you can be anywhere, and you're just talking to people that, people in those groups are like your buddies or, they become friends very fast. So, you don't even really feel like you're working most of the time. Dude, it's been awesome. It's been a pleasure to hear all the stories and stuff. So for people listening, where can they find out more about you?
I'm on Instagram at Brandon T. Webb. My website is just my full name, BrandonTylerWebb.com. That's my author page. And I'm active on Instagram. So, people can reach out there. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.